Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today, in the studio, we'll look at the best of four formative Van Halen albums by the four musicians who made them.
We weren't really thinking about the money at that time either, I don't think. I think we were just having so much fun doing what we were doing and being as new as we were to it. It was like, hey, because, you know, it didn't take much to make me happier. You know, as long as I had a roof over my head, I didn't care. That, to me, was all icing on the cake. They were letting us record and go out and play our music, and that's all we cared about.
Until finally, like I said, on the fifth day.
No, it was more like 2 weeks.
Actually. Okay. The 15th day, the second chord came. That second chord is very important, you know.
You know, Ed was the one who got the actress, or, you know, the model, that type of deal before Dave did. And I think that really kind of got under Dave's skin. Hey, this is Michael Anthony of Van Halen, and I am in the studio for Van Halen 2.
The quintessential American hard rock band, Van Halen, sporting three of the original members who ensured their election to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on the first ballot. Van Halen's 1978 debut, with sales now over 7 million, became a benchmark for every hard rock band and album ever since. And 6 years later, they even topped that with 1984, one of the most popular and influential hard rock albums ever. Every Van Halen album between those two bookends of the original era would sell a million plus copies or more and chart in the top six in sales. Yet by 1982's Diver Down album, Van Halen had become a series of contradictions due to opposing forces inside and outside of the lineup of guitar phenom Eddie Van Halen, drummer brother Alex, bass player and backing vocalist Michael Anthony, and world-class showman, singer David Lee Roth. Alex Van Halen reminded me just how visceral, how primal, their creative process has always been.
When we're in the studio and the amps are cranked to 11 on the dial, and you're having a great time playing it, I think that's the one thing you shouldn't forget. You know, we've been looking at songs as how do you write them, how do you come up with the ideas, but once you start playing, it's kind of a perpetual thing. The fact that it sounds so great and that your hair is blowing back about at 100 miles an hour from the sound bouncing around tends to feed itself.
During Van Halen's first tour in 1978, it didn't take long for us in the rock media to focus on the witty bon vivant frontman David Lee Roth, whose acrobatic theatrics certainly came in handy for the emerging video era in America with the dawn of MTV in 1982. Van Halen original member Michael Anthony agrees.
Yeah, actually it did. Because David, one thing he had always been really, him and also a guy by the name of Pete Angelus, who was our lighting director, and they were always focused on, you know, how the band looked. And I remember even a couple of the early tours that we actually brought in a couple of people to try to work choreography with the band. And Eddie, Alex, and myself would be going, whoa, hey, you know, this guy would be going, yeah, Dave, well, you back up here, and then Mike, you roll over his back, and then Dave, then, you know, you do a somersault here, and we'd be going, geez, what the heck, you know, what are we doing here? But, yeah, in that respect, I mean, we were all set to do videos because between Dave and Pete Angelus, they had plenty of ideas.
Oh,
Dance the Night Away appeared on the February 1979 Van Halen 2, and as Guitar Player magazine polls were all recognizing the innovative talents of Eddie Van Halen as best new guitarist, the stacked background vocals were turning out to be an equally signature sound, unique in hard rock. David Lee Roth told me it was nothing but a Motown thing.
As a riff, it's designed to be the killer riff, but you pick up on all these vocal harmonies that come in on the choruses, you know, that come in on those B parts. That's my old Motown learning. You know, I went to grade school, junior high, high school that were 90%, 95% black and Hispanic, you know, when they started integrational busing over in Pasadena, California. But everything I was listening to at the youth club dance was Standing in the Shadows of Love. But that's where the harmonies come from. And that dates back to early Van Halen stuff when we had lead bass drums and me, and we were playing cover tunes in all the bars. We'd play 200 songs by other people, whether it was Elton John or the Ohio Players, James Brown, Led Zeppelin, you name it. But we had no keyboard. We had no pumping brass section, you know, and this kind of thing. So what are we going to do to add a little color to the chorus? We'll sing. Okay, a novel idea. Let's get some harmonies going here, which to this day is fairly rare in big rock sound. You'll hear a lot of vocals stacked up in unison. It's kind of a gang thing. We say we want wild. This kind of thing. But as far as 4 and 5 part harmonies and things like this, this is the Temptations played to the background of Heartbreaker by Led Zeppelin.
Though that 1978 debut album was quickly on its way to an eventual 7 million copies in sales, nevertheless, Van Halen's record company was seemingly disappointed that it didn't contain a top 40 single that they could exploit. I reminded former Van Halen bassist Michael Anthony that Van Halen 2 leads off with a cover of You're No Good.
I don't know. I think a lot of that had to do with the band, too, because we, you know, obviously we were always consider ourselves a live band, and back the first album, second album. I mean, we had a lot of original material of our own stuff. In fact, even, God, past 1984, 51, 50, we were still using bits and pieces of the original demo that we cut for Ted Templeman. And so I think back then it wasn't really, we didn't really feel the stress that much because we had so much material and we were still just weeding through, you know, a lot of stuff that we had before we were even signed. That was like, oh, you need another album right away and go back out on the road. And of course, back then we were having so much fun. We were very new to touring and all this interrelationship with the other bands that we'd only read about and whatever, and all the stuff that went on live, that we were like, yeah, you know, we'll do another album, we'll go right back out on the road, and we had plenty of material. So I don't think back then we really felt the pressure as much because we did have a lot of material and we were ready to just record and go out and play it.
It was on that 1979 second national tour that I started getting reports from insiders on the tour that the boys in the band were regularly setting new lows in groupie debauchery. Michael Anthony blushes, but he won't deny the unofficial tour name.
Or is that the Hide Your Sheep? Oh, I remember. We had jackets and we had t-shirts made up. In fact, I've still got one somewhere of a sheep with its head. It's facing away from you with its head turning around looking, and it's wearing garters and fishnet stockings. And I think that was more for our crew, because back then, believe me, it was like every other week, it looked like the free clinic backstage with a line coming out of a room about a half mile long, the doctor in there seeing half our crew, and they're all walking out shaking their heads.
Oh,
it was a ravenous time. There was a lot of debacle stuff going on. We'll be right back.
Oh, obviously the inspiration for Somebody Get Me a Doctor on Van Halen 2. The Van Halen brothers were no strangers to trouble growing up in and around Pasadena in Southern California. Here's Alex and Eddie.
No different than, I think, anybody else who is searching for something in their life when...
We never hurt anybody, put it that way.
Nothing was ever done maliciously, but Ed and I always had this whether it's an itch or a desire or a need to express ourselves a certain way. And fortunately, we found music. And fortunately, it happened at an early age. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, because that's why some people turn to drugs, some people turn to violence, some people turn to football, whatever it is. You need to have some way to express yourself. And yeah, when we were in our so-called formative years, Ed and I used to get in some rumbles, you know, big deal. But when we finally got the band, what we thought was in a reasonable position of competence, if you want to call it that, we used to play for the Hells Angels. Remember those guys? You know, just sit there and hang around with a bunch of guys. I was just waiting to make a mistake, having all those guys grab a chain and just wrap it around my neck and say, hey, you made a mistake, mother.
Original bass player Michael Anthony recalls that 1979 Van Halen tour as a time when everybody in the band had the same simple motives.
We weren't really thinking about the money at that time either, I don't think. I think we were just having so much fun doing what we were doing and being as new as we were to it that the money was, I mean, any kind of a paycheck I remember getting and seeing, I was going, Whoa, what a trip. Check that out, you know? it was like, hey, because, you know, it didn't take much to make me happier. You know, as long as I had a roof over my head, I didn't care. So, I mean, that to me was all icing on the cake. You know, they were letting us record and go out and play our music, and that's all we cared about.
But Anthony admits that their label, in-house producer, the veteran Ted Templeman, continued to lobby Van Halen to record previous hits by others.
Right. But we never wanted to consider ourselves or think of ourselves as a hit or a singles band. And that's why we'd always, you know, when Ted Templeman would say, hey, let's do a remake of You're No Good, that could be a hit again, or let's do a remake of Dancing in the Street or this or that. And especially Eddie, I think, even though I know he would have rather have had a Van Halen hit, and I think that's the way the record company was kind of, you know, if Van Halen's not going to have their own hit, maybe let's do a remake and have a hit of the remake of You're No Good or something like that, you know.
Smoking and drinking on ringside, on top of the world, oh yeah. She had a drink in her hand, she had a toast in the sand, oh, whoa, what a beautiful girl. We'll be right back.
smoking and a drinking, I'm ringside. I'm top of the world.
Top of the world.
I got a drink in my hand, I got my toes in the sand. All I need is a beautiful girl.
Big Wet One from Van Halen lead singer David Lee Roth at the very end of Beautiful Girls from 1979's Van Halen 2. Next, Roth reminds us that necessity is the mother of invention. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit inthestudio.net for back episodes with all of your favorite bands. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Eddie and Alex Van Halen, David Lee Roth, and former member Michael Anthony for Van Halen 2.
Hi, I'm Alex Van Halen, and you're not.
Hey, this is Eddie Van Halen in the studio.
Yours truly, David Lee, right here with Redbeard.
Hey, Michael Anthony here. Right now, I'm in the studio, and we are talking about Women and Children First.
Thanks, everybody. All four of these guys could sing tight chorused vocals, even in the Sunset Strip clubs, a real bonus that Van Halen producer Ted Templeman utilized like another instrument when recording those early Van Halen albums. While necessity may be the mother of invention, lead singer David Lee Roth reveals that poverty was the daddy.
It's purely a case, Redbeard, of history for all the wrong reasons. All we were trying to do was cover up that we were too cheap to hire a keyboard player. All we did was try and cover up the idea that, no, we didn't want a rhythm guitar player, you know, and this sort of thing. So you got to give a little color, a little life. And there's so many things you can do with voices, but it's very difficult, and it takes hundreds of hours of rehearsal, of repetition, to get it right, to really make it zing, not sing, but zing, pop, fizzle, you know, like that. Most people, most musicians, singers, whatever out there, have the facility to do it. It just takes literally hundreds of hours, and you really have to enjoy the music to get yourself through a program like that.
here's Grants.
Van Halen's third album, Women and Children First, appeared in 1980, the opening sounds on And the Cradle Will Rock just about tore your ears off. How'd they do that? Here are Eddie and Alex Van Halen.
2 weeks straight in Dave's father's basement. I got this Wurlitzer piano.
Through a Marshall amp.
Through my Marshall amps. And just every day, Al and I would go in there, don't.
For hours.
For 2 weeks.
We just, for hours.
Going, this is really cool.
But where's that next chord?
Yeah.
Where's that next chord?
Find that chord. Boom. Look, the 15th day, yeah. There it came, and it just, boom. Magic, you know. But we pounded that song.
Into the ground.
Yeah. Just that chorus riff for 2 weeks straight.
But what's great about it...
I just couldn't find where... I didn't know where to go from there. And all of a sudden, boom, it came.
What's great about it is it's like entrainment. You know, it's as old as shamans. It's as old as African drumming. It's as old as anything that people do to get themselves in a different state of mind. We would sit there and play that thing until we became almost hypnotic and didn't realize what time it was. 5 hours would go by.
Oh, yeah.
And play the same damn thing until finally, like Ed said, on the fifth day...
No, it was more like 2 weeks.
Alex. Okay. The 15th day, the second chord came. That second chord is very important, you know.
For certain, Van Halen is equaled only by Pink Floyd as the longest-running soap opera in rock. Even by the time of Women and Children First, Eddie Van Halen had already copped 2 Guitar Player of the Year awards, so it's ironic that Eddie rocked the cradle with a special effects-laden keyboard. According to Michael Anthony, not everybody in the band was supportive.
I remember the first time Ed even got on a keyboard... and showed something to Dave, and Dave was like, oh, no, you can't do that. You're a guitar hero. Guitar heroes, you play guitar. You don't play keyboard, man. You are a guitar hero. Do not play keyboard. And, you know, that frustrated him also because, you know, it wasn't like a conscious thing that, hey, we ought to add keyboard or whatever. But, you know, it was just another facet of Ed Van Halen. That guy, since the first day I met him, he's always goofing around with different instruments, trying to make, you know, or coming up with different sounds. And, you know, not because he's searching for something, but because he enjoys doing it. And I think, you know, it was just a combination of everything. Plus, like, you know, there was some substance abuse, you know, within the band back then, too. But I think it was just kind of a culmination of all that. At that point, we were just having so much fun. And it's like all your dreams are beginning to come true that we didn't even realize what was happening. And we had Ted Templeman in there, of course, who was like kind of like being the band leader at that point and just kind of telling us, yeah, you should do this and that. And us being new in the studio into the whole thing, we were just like, yeah, okay. So, God, I don't even think it was till Women and Children First or right around there where we actually were really kind of like, you know, whoa, hey, you know, let's and start grabbing the reins a little bit there, you know.
While on tour in Shreveport, Louisiana, Eddie Van Halen was introduced to favorite daughter Valerie Bertinelli, a popular TV actress at the time. Again, not everybody in the band was supportive. Here's Ed.
Yeah, I'd say starting so, because I met Valerie then, and Dave didn't dig that, because all of a sudden here I am in the globe and all of the rags, which right. Is totally not me, you know? I mean, it's kind of like the fame part was coming to me, which I don't dig. I just want to make music, you know, and it's what he wanted, and it just created tension, yeah, it did.
Truth is that Michael Anthony also got married at the same time, yet the tabloids ignored it, and no one in Van Halen seemed to mind.
I got married in 81, actually 2 months before Ed got married. It was so weird because, you know, it's funny too because we just finished our tour. Kenny Wayne Shepherd opened up much of the summer for us, and it was his father actually who was a DJ or something like that in the Shreveport area that was partly instrumental in hooking Valerie up to come to our show when she first met Ed. I remember him walking up to him going, "Hey, thanks a lot, man," you know, making some kind of a joke out of it. But yeah, I think it was Valerie's brother who went to him or something like that, and got it set up for her to come backstage to our show in Shreveport and meet Ed. And after the show, I remember she came back to the hotel and they just kind of like were walking around, and I think they talked almost all night. Meanwhile, I met two of Valerie's brothers, and we proceeded to trash half the hotel we were staying in. I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was going, "Hey, man, she's got a couple of great brothers. You know, we were having a great time." But, you know, I think... out of anybody in the band, it hit Dave the hardest because I think, you know, Ed was the one who got the actress, you know, the model, that type of deal before Dave did. And I think that really kind of got under Dave's skin.
Everybody wants some, I want some too. Whoa.
Everybody wants some. How about you? Still to come, Eddie and Alex Van Halen, David Lee Roth, and Michael Anthony give us fair warning of a rough patch dead ahead for Van Halen. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear what you've been missing at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for Van Halen's Fair Warning.
Hi, I'm Alex Van Halen, and you're not.
Hey, this is Eddie Van Halen in the studio.
Yours truly, David Lee, right here with Redbeard.
Thank you, Diamond Dave, a nickname the original and current lead singer earned in part because of his natural penchant for the glitz of show business, a trait not shared by Eddie and Alex Van Halen.
From the very beginning, we just felt like, okay, if that was what you want me to wear, okay, you know?
Yeah.
He used to rag my ass about the way I dressed.
So one day I wore a dress.
Yeah, he did. He wore a dress. Yeah. Here.
To the studio. Here.
Just in the studio. Yeah,
showed
like
up
it.
In a dress. Oh, yeah.
The worst part was driving. People seeing me. The thing you have to remember, in music there is a creative side. There is the, what I guess we'll call the self-indulgent side, meaning how you want to express yourself. But there's also a side of other people, how they think you should appear. If you're going to play a wedding, you have to wear a tuxedo, or else you ain't getting the gig. It's that simple. At that time, people were so image conscious, or at least to a certain extent of how things should look, like you said, with the poofy hair and the rest of the stuff. To be quite honest with you, even now, things have changed to the point where now people are trying so hard
not to
be something. They shave their heads. They pierce every part of their body they can imagine.
Ugly is in.
No, I wouldn't say ugly,
well,
but
it's just
you know what it is. It's just human nature. That's all it is.
But
it's very simple. Because the bottom line is, when you
close your eyes and listen to music, what's the damn difference?
When you were born, and when I were born, we didn't know about shirts or pants. We didn't speak the English language. No. But because you hang with other people, you have to communicate, and certain people relate to certain ways, whether it's a dress or the language or the look. It's that simple. We were just jeans and t-shirts.
I recorded all first four records with that same blue shirt.
Break
coming up.
Change.
Halen off the chain for 1981's Fair Warning album, reportedly an arduous recording which fell largely on the shoulders of Eddie Van Halen. What made it a breech berth for Ed? Was it persistent pressure to record outside material? Personality clashes inside the band? Drugs and alcohol? Here's former member and original bass player Michael Anthony.
Yeah, I think it was probably a little bit of everything like that. I mean, because those were times also where he would spend a lot of time in the studio, him and Don Landy. Sometimes, you know, they'd pull all-nighters or stay up for like 2-3 days. And, you know, I just think it was just kind of a combination of everything, plus the ongoing, the thing that was starting to grow with our relationship and between us and Roth, which would eventually come to a head during the 1984 tour. I think, you know, that was part of it also. That plus the fact, you know, Ted Templeman and, you know, the wanting to do remakes of songs and Ed wanting to do his own thing.
Which now included Mrs. Edward Van Halen. As a popular TV actress, Valerie Bertinelli felt that she had showbiz cred, which didn't always fit with David Lee Roth's opinions.
Right, yeah, you could always feel the tension in the room when those two either were talking with each other or, you know, I mean, they got along, you could tell, they got along, and, you know, I know Dave was also doing it for Ed's sake, you know, you didn't want any tension within the band, but you could tell that, you know, that something wasn't right there. That, and plus, Valerie, she's very opinionated and very strong-willed. And, you know, she would say, if she didn't think that something was right, let's say if Dave had Ed wearing something or whatever, she'd go, Ed, I don't think that looks right. You know, you ought to tell Dave and whatever. And up to that point, you know, we had been pretty passive with Dave as far as a lot of things concerning the band, like the interviews, stuff like that. And all of a sudden, is like Ed was going, hey, Dave, you know, I don't think blah, blah, blah. And it's like, ooh. And I think, and Dave knew that Valerie was a part of that. And I think that even, you know, made the tension even worse.
Check me out on the good side here. When my baby's on the corner and she's looking so fine. Put one and one together and it blew my mind. A man needs love to live. I'm the living proof. Catch that smile and I have the roof. Big double take. Keep on walking. I'm in love. What's over? I'm overdone.
This is love.
Ooh, I need your loving. Come on, baby, take me home.
This is love.
Ooh, I need your loving. I'm just
In the shoulda, woulda, coulda department, I'll never understand why the Poppin' Little Shuffle Is This Love from 1981's Fair Warning album wasn't a huge hit for Van Halen. Alex Van Halen found the disappointment deeply affecting.
I don't write lyrics, but I same as with music, that when you bare your soul and you put your heart and soul into something and you give it to somebody else to kind of judge it, I mean, that is part of you is being judged. And if they say, hey, man, this really, I mean, this is bad. This is bad news. And you feel it's a personal, not only an insult, but, oh, my God, you know, am I really a jerk or something? So it can be
put it out on the old chopping block.
It can be very emotional.
So as I said, by 1982, Van Halen had become a series of contradictions. And while their fifth album, Diver Down, did peak at number three sales, fully half of the songs were oldies by other bands. You know, cover versions that would have been in Van Halen's bar band sets back on the Sunset Strip when label producer Ted Templeman first saw the band, according to former member Michael Anthony.
Well, yeah, Ted was always the kind of guy who always was looking for a hit. You know, he had bands like the Doobie Brothers and Lynn Ronstadt and people like that that were always, you know, very hit-oriented. And I remember he'd always say, why don't you guys try doing a remake of this song? That could be a hit again. I always remember Ted saying that. And I think it was our Diver Down album was where that all really kind of came to a head, because I think at least half that album was cover songs. And it was at that point that I remember Ed standing back and going, hey, wait a minute here. You know, this is Van Halen. We have our own music. We have our own thing to say. And Ted was trying to, you know, and Dave, in a way, was kind of with that, too. You know, we're looking for that hit, but looking for it that way, you know, rather than trying to write our own Stairway to Heaven.
I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after the jump. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Eddie and Alex Van Halen, David Lee Roth, and Michael Anthony. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter. And for this and many more of your favorite rockers, visit inthestudio.net.